few weeks ago, members of the community had a chance to visit Yosemite. We went in two trips, and it was a good little break from the routine, about 6 days out in Yosemite National Park. This is usually the case when we've fallen into a kind of comfortable rhythm, as we tend to here in the monastery. You don't really notice what's been going on in your practice. Don't really notice the ways that you've changed and grown, and the ways that your mind has developed, and how it deals with problems. But then as soon as you're put in a different situation, it just appears before you. You react in a way you've never reacted before, and it's really when we get to see what the practice is about. Sometimes the slow and steady routine. It's fruitful, but we might not get to taste the fruits, because it's also a steady training. We're continually practicing, continually developing, but then we get out of that environment and the pressure's off, and it all comes out at once. And so I was in Yosemite, and I mentioned this to Ajahn. Ajahn Jyotipala was there as well. There was, 3 or 4 days into the trip, we were looking at going over to the other side of the valley we were on, and just doing a day hike up among the glaciers. The only slight difficulty was that there was a river running through the center of this valley, and because of rain and snowpack melting, and also because of the coming winter, and they were opening the dam above this river, is that the river was a lot higher than it had been in previous years. So all of the points of crossing that had gone before were used to were all flooded. They were missing. So before we could get over to the other side, the day before, the idea kind of came up that we'd just go looking for a way to get across this river, looking for old crossings, or at least just following it until I found a crossing. And so I was trudging along, and part of the difficulty I had was that I had expectations. Little seeds of dukkha. And so I already had these images of crossings in my mind, because I had been there before. So I knew what I was looking for. The only problem was they weren't there anymore. And once, twice, three times, all down the stream, I'd go over to the stream and I'd recognize a particular bend, but there'd be no stepping stones, or I'd be able to see the stepping stones, but they were under a foot of water. And so I was going farther and farther from our campsite and more into the woods, and just wasn't finding anything. There was just, in my mind, there was no way to get across the stream, the river. And then I was, quite far up, just a short ways below the dam itself, where there'd be an obvious crossing. And all at once, it kind of occurred to me that the whole difficulty was that I was asking the wrong question. I was approaching a problem in the wrong way. The question I was asking was, where's the crossing? But the proper question was, will my boots get wet? And as soon as I turned it around, as soon as I recognized what I was trying to do as opposed to what I wanted to do, then it became really easy. I could look at that one stretch of river in front of me and just answer the question. You know, if I cross there, yes, very wet. If I cross up there, not so wet. And then I could evaluate that, and well, it was just the bottom of my boots would get wet. Well, they're made of rubber. That's not even a problem. And as soon as I changed the question, there was no difficulty. There was no problem. And I walked back. I said I knew where the crossing was. And to me, that was a noticeable insight, a useful one. I could say, hey, look what my mind did. I'm pretty clever. That's probably, yeah, Ajahn Jyotipala could appreciate it the first time I said it, but if I kept saying it, you know, but you know, I got it. You know, I really got it. Did you get it? I flipped it around. I overcame dukkha. It would probably lose its appeal after about the second time I said it. And that just goes to show that, well, some insights are really great and flashy, and we overcome dukkha and we get across a big, swollen, raging river without hardly getting wet. We shouldn't really be taken in by the big, flashy insights. You know, the reality is, we make those little intuitive leaps all the time. I hadn't invented being clever. You know, I'm not even particularly good at it. You know, it's one time seemed novel. Whether the results are great or small, they reflect exactly what we're here to cultivate. They reflect the path itself, overcoming suffering, recognizing the cause of suffering, and relinquishing that cause, and just changing our approach so that the problem ceases to be a problem, or at least it becomes a problem that we can look at objectively, that we can use a judgment of quality rather than quantity. It's impossible to get across that river without getting a little wet. And I say, you know, where is the crossing? I'm asking, where is the magical bridge that where you don't even touch the water? And in the end, we actually did look for that bridge. We spent a few hours going the other side of the river, but besides the point. And then in all of this, it might seem that the fourth noble truth is kind of absent. The first three were big and obvious, but it's just that simple process, problem, the cause, relinquishment, the solution, just that we do this over and over and over, that we make a habit of it, and that we get good at it. That's the path, that's the training, and when it becomes natural, then it won't even seem clever, but in reality, what's special about that is then there won't be any more problems. So I offer this reflection for tonight.
Andamayam dhammakataya sadhukaram dadamase
sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Bhutang dhammang sanghang namassami.
I think one of the strongest things that came up for me during this rains retreat was something I reflect on a lot. But I think, as happens often, we reflect on things a lot, and then the reality actually faces us a lot more clearly, and we're surprised. We still find we're surprised. So we do a lot of chanting here, a lot of reflecting on separation from those that are dear to us, and being of the nature to age, sicken, and die. And then somehow we're often surprised when the reality comes to pass or brings up things that we didn't really actually see very clearly, that were lurking underneath the skin, so to speak. So I reflect a lot about my parents. They're dear to me. I have a lot of gratitude to my parents. I try to spend time with them when I can, do things to help them out. I have a lot of love for them. And I spent 2 weeks with my parents helping to drive them to Montana, where they're from. And the one thing that has changed is that when I first started driving them, it used to have moments that were extremely trying, because I hadn't spent that kind of concentrated time with them in a long time. So I found things that actually really pushed buttons, and family, no matter how dear they are to us, the buttons are there, and they're buttons that we've been working on all our lives. So, and over the years, I've come to really actually, part of the positive side of that reflection is I've actually, it has gotten enough that I have realized my time with them is very precious, and I don't want to waste it. Try to be as skillful as I can when I'm with them and use that time as well as I can. And my mom, before they weren't even sure they were going to go this year, because she's had a lot of physical problems, and she, in all seriousness, decided that if she wanted to have some tests done first, she didn't want to die in Montana and leave us with the burden of getting her body back to California. So, and she was quite sincere in that reflection. But we had a really good trip. She did really well. She was really happy she went. I was very grateful for the time with them, grateful for the opportunity to give something back. And then it was right before I was supposed to actually begin my 2-week retreat, kind of winding things down in the office, and got a call from my sister that my mom had gone into emergency with a heart rate of 166. And of course, it brought up first this sense of urgency of how I had to get down there. But I don't have a car, and it really wasn't very realistic in that moment. So the practice is always teaching us and reminding us to center ourselves again if we see that we're going off. So I was able to kind of let go of some of that urgency, but always there was this kind of voice in the back, wondering what was going to unfold and feeling like it actually was appropriate for me to get down to be with her. I was mostly concerned her previous hospital experience had been really unpleasant for her. She had been under anesthetics, drugs, and it had caused some hallucinating for her, and very unpleasant experience. So that was actually primary in my mind, was that I wanted to, if she was going to have to stay in the hospital, I wanted to try to be there to help her and to help support her through that, so she didn't experience that same kind of dread and fear and paranoia, really. But it wasn't to be. So the next day I called to find out what was happening, and I spoke to her, and she was doing much better, and she was actually very peaceful, very calm. And I was really interested to see in myself how that affected me, because that peacefulness and calmness and acceptance, she was comfortable, she felt she was being taken care of, that just transferred to me so quickly. And I felt that urgency of getting down there. I still wanted to go, but it dropped away. And I, at this moment where I thought, well, if I don't make it down and something happens and she dies, she's peaceful. That actually made me feel not happy and joyful, but it did make me feel some sense of that, some sense of ease about it all. But then, of course, it always brings up that reflection again. I am of the nature to die. Those that are near and dear to me are of the nature to die. We will become separated. And it's just the inevitable comma of having been born, having these relationships. And it's just the cycles of life. And so it's interesting at tea time, because somebody asked a question about karma and also dedicating merit. And that's something that came up for me very strongly at that time with my parents, because I've often kind of felt that anything that I did, I automatically just shared with them. And then there was a monk visiting from Thailand, and I asked him about it, because I know it's a big part of his practice is sharing merit, like in a big way, like a really clear and intentional way. And I asked him about that, and he said, no, it's really good to actually do it in a really clear, intentional way, not just kind of, well, I always, anything I do, I share my merit with my parents. He's like, no, you actually have to, you want to bring it up, you want to make that intention bolder, make it more clear. And so just started really working on that and reflecting on, I've always had this thought that I want, if my parents get sick, I want to be there to take care of them. But I've always also had this, a semi-realization that, number one, I may not live longer than them. I could die before they even get sicker or anything. But also, I don't know where I'll be. I can't guarantee that what it's going to be like. Everything's uncertain. So I did go down. I was able to get a ride a few days later. And it was also it was supposed to be the first day of my retreat. And I had just decided, well, I'll go down and just help. My mom was out of the hospital by that time, was settling into some new medications. Go spend some time with them, make sure they're settling in. And it will be the first part of my retreat will be my gratitude retreat, my opportunity to act on the gratitude that I feel for them. And I'm also grateful because there's a sense of preciousness in that opportunity, and that I had yet another opportunity to be in that position and to actually be with them and do things for them and help them with things and have the opportunity to be reminded again that every time I see them, I see a bit more frailty. And I see that my dad's short-term memory is kind of crumbling, and my mom's physical body is kind of crumbling. And I'm reminded of that, that this is the preciousness of life. This is a precious opportunity for me to reflect on the gratitude that I have for them, an opportunity to give something back, to be a, take what Dhamma I have, and if all I can offer is to be a calm presence, then that's what I can do. And really work on that intention of wanting to share any goodness that I might do in my life, really intentionally sharing that with my parents. And there's a lot of joy in that, actually, in that reflection. There's a lot of joy in the heart, in the feeling of just the ability to feel that sincerely. And it's also a real aid to inspiring me to keep on track and to follow through on those good intentions as much as possible. So in the end, we all benefit. And I'm sure, I realize I'm going to die, my parents are going to die at some level, and I'm sure the surprises still are waiting for me because that uncertainty is still there. And so it's just a matter of to keep going back. I just have to keep reminding myself, keep going back to this practice, keep reminding myself. And then hopefully when the moment comes of accepting my own illness, death, whatever, accepting the death or illness of those dear to me, then hopefully I can keep coming back to that center, that place of being grounded. And karma will happen, and karma, I'm sure there will be more karma created, and hopefully it will be kusala, meritorious. And provide that sense of urgency to not waste time. And that reflection that how blessed we've been, blessed I've been to have Dhamma in my life, and the opportunity to develop tools, and the opportunity to be around so many wonderful teachers, such a supportive community, people with a really sincere aspirations, incredible faith in the people that come to visit. Yeah, we're all very blessed. I'll stop there.
Pandamayam Dhammakataya Sadhukaranda Dhammase Sadhu 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 Anumodami.
If you don't mind, at the end of the Dhamma talk, let's put this all off on the
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So for my reflection tonight, I thought I would just talk about a few things that I've kind of been working with and exploring over the past few months. As an Anagarika here, most of my time when I'm not meditating is kind of spent around the kitchen, really, kind of helping prepare food and kind of looking after the kitchen, cleaning and organizing and so that's really other than the when I'm kind of meditating or taking part in other kind of community activities, that's kind of where most of my practice occurs. And really just been looking at that area. And really just, examining the suffering that arises there and trying to figure out, why it arises, why there's suffering there, and trying to remedy it, and trying to work with that. And I think for everyone, really, there's probably some suffering that occurs when kind of working in an environment like, the kitchen, where it can often be quite stressful and busy. But for me, I think there are several reasons that I do experience suffering kind of in that environment, but the one area that I've really been noticing a lot, and kind of more and more actually as I look closer at it, is just really attachment to views and opinions, and really how it's really caused me quite a lot of suffering. And I think it's, it's probably pretty similar for everyone. And it really, I think, applies to a lot of, other areas of our lives. But just, being attached to our views and opinions that we have about anything, which is just, almost natural, is really, really kind of, constricting and burdensome on the heart. It feels that attachment really brings with it inability to compromise, inability to kind of see things more broadly. I know for myself, when I'm often have very can be quite strong opinions how I think how things should be done in the kitchen, how a certain dish should be cooked, and how how things should be organized, and how things should be run, and things like that. Really, into that view and not seeing it as just a view, really, you know, really, really brings with it suffering. And so I've just really been trying to see that more and more. Perhaps it's most evident for me when kind of my views conflict with views of other people. You know, if I kind of have my own views, and I'm kind of operating maybe alone, you know, it's okay. But kind of, you know, working with others, we all bring our own views and opinions with us. And so just often finding myself kind of reacting to things that, you know, someone does something in a certain way, and I think that's strange. I don't think that's right, and I don't think that's the best way to do something. And for a long time, you know, really getting caught up in that reaction, kind of being irritated or kind of angry, and kind of, you know, really even just holding on to that anger for quite a while, and just kind of having this, you know, kind of burning suffering. My practice has just really consisted of slowly trying to see that process for what it is, and just you know, not trying to push my views away, not trying to kind of eradicate them, but just seeing that, you know, it's just a view, and other people have their views. And really, in the end, it's you know, I have a choice to either hold on to my view and think it's the only right, like the only way that things can be done. And if I choose to do that, then I'm just basically choosing suffering. Or I can try to, you know, try to let go of that that attachment to the view. And at this point, I really haven't been able to do that very often. I usually fall into, you know, kind of getting caught up with it. But you know, just really the couple of times that I've been able to let go a little bit, it's just this feeling of, you know, just peace, and feels so much better than just kind of holding on and clinging to these things. Offer that for reflection.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Bhutang saranang bhutang dhammang sanghang. Someone help me out here. Namasami. When I was in high school, many years ago, there was a band called the Violent Femmes, and on their first album, the last song is called Good Feeling. And essentially the chorus is good feeling. Won't you stay with me just a little longer? It always seems like you're leaving when I need you here with me just a little longer. And I think even back then, the song struck me as being quite profound. Because usually rock songs are about, you know, a person, a particular person. Or something else. It's not about that, and it just sort of struck straight to the point a bit. Because with whatever it was that I was after, whether it was another person or a movie or music or food, it was really about some feeling. A good feeling, a pleasant feeling. That I was always chasing. And I mean, the examples of that are just rampant when I reflect back. You know, going all over the world just trying to feel good. Trying to get a good feeling and then try to hold on to it. And the Buddha's own words on good feelings are, well, feelings, that there's three kinds. There's pleasant ones, unpleasant ones, and neutral ones. And that's the way it is. It isn't only pleasant ones. And that feelings are anicca, dukkha, anatta. Feelings change. The anicca part of it, they change. It's just the way they are. There's no such thing as a good feeling, a permanent good feeling, which I think is what I was after. I'm sure I still am, you know, to some degree. But at least now there's a bit more awareness and hopefully a bit more wisdom around the topic. The struggle and the search. And when I started meditating, I experienced feelings. I was a freshman in college. I experienced feelings that I'd never experienced before. More satisfying. Really, really nice. And I'm pretty sure I've spent that was 1833. The last 15 years since trying to get those back. I fear that's a common phenomena with meditators. They'll start meditating and they get these really, really nice feelings and experiences, and then they'll never be able to get them back again. which is totally okay, because luckily that's not where it's at. So these teachings on how to relate to feelings, how to relate to everything, obviously, but here, feelings. That there's other options, which ironically lead to good feelings and pleasant feelings, more so than holding on and clutching and clinging. But that it isn't about the feeling. That what it is that we're after is well, I guess I can't really speak on that one, because it's beyond, it's not a feeling. And it's beyond description, it's beyond thought. But the way that we relate to feelings, we have a whole range of possibilities: kindness, compassion, gratitude, gladness, equanimity, patience, letting go, forgiveness. Mindfulness, just feeling the feeling, just experiencing it instead of. So the whole other range of possibilities of how we can relate to our feelings unskillfully, holding on, clinging, fighting, fearing, hating, worrying, wanting. It was like El Dorado, which is the city of gold, this mythical city somewhere in South America that explorers literally went looking for, certainly in this century, and I believe also in the last. It made me think of some permanent feeling, some permanent bliss, permanent peace in a feeling form. And I was in this meditation group in Berkeley, and there was this guy that was also part of the group, and I thought I was hung up on, you know, looking for that perfect feeling that was permanent. And it was really kind of heartbreaking listening to him talk about it, because I could hear the suffering there. It was like the practice was about getting that feeling and holding on to it. And I don't mean to say that parts of the practice aren't about cultivating pleasant feelings, so we can then contemplate and investigate. It's crucial. But I am saying, as an end result, in my own experience, it doesn't work very well. And I guess if one was hell-bent on finding a permanent, pleasant feeling, then yeah, this would be pretty depressing. But if one was willing to work with things as they are, there are the third and fourth noble truths, which say that there is an end of suffering, Nibbana, I mean, whatever you want to call it, there is that. And there's a way, there's a path which leads to that. And it might not be trying to bring about and hold on to pleasant feelings. Well, it isn't, the way it's laid out. Similar to what Thambamutu was saying, it's a sort of restructuring of the way that one looks at it. If I'm willing to transfer my faith or transfer what it is I'm looking for, wanting, I can get it to work. It's a poor way of phrasing it, but it can work. And I can't totally wrap my head around it, what it might be. I mean, we have clues. We talk a lot about the one who knows. Awareness, mindfulness. Ajahn Chah called it not clinging. But I think it's really important for me just to say that it's something. Even if it isn't something, that there is something. Because I feel like a lot of times people stop at the first and second noble truth. And it would be pretty depressing if that's all there was. And they don't go on to the third and fourth, which is totally not depressing, which is quite a lot of hope. It's complete hope, complete possibility. So I'll offer that for your reflection.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. often in overarching descriptions of the path, one hears about certain condensed sets, like sila, samadhi, panya, or dana, sila, bhavana. But there's another set which is not mentioned as often, at least in this tradition, but which I feel is it's worth bringing up, it's worth thinking about. This is a pariyatti, patipatti, and pativedi. So in this, the foundation stone of one's practice is in pariyatti, which literally it means mastery or accomplishment, but it specifically means mastery of the teachings, or accomplishment in study. And this took on the more specific meaning of like developing a thorough understanding of the suttas. And then patipatti is related to patipada, the path of practice. And then pativedi is realization or comprehension, penetrating the truth of the teachings and the practice of it. So it's leading all the way up to full realization. So I think just looking at this first step of pariyatti, there's often a tendency to almost skip past it. A lot of people start off practice just jumping directly into patipatti. In my own case, I had almost no understanding of Buddhist doctrine or teachings when I started meditating. So initially, there was just an enormous amount of focus on that. And that, there's nothing wrong with that, but it did have kind of a ethereal, ungrounded, somewhat basis quality to it, somewhat aimless. So something that I've been doing more lately is coming back to the real foundation for it. It's like, where does one place one's meditation practice on top of? And one places it on top of a really fundamental understanding of just what it was that the Buddha was trying to say to us. Just what were the teacher's instructions? What was it that was passed on? And there's a few ways to look at this. One is just a very pragmatic thing, in that without some kind of understanding of what the teachings are, then there's no practice. And it's really as simple as that. If you don't know how to practice, then you can't practice. So one basis of pariyatti is just developing enough of an understanding of how to meditate, what we're aiming at, the overarching mind state which one is developing, such that one can orient oneself in the general direction of realization. And that's perfectly valid. And I think for many people that's more or less where it starts and where it stops. It's like this idea of you just get just enough that you can go and meditate. And for some people, I think that's perfectly suitable. But what I've been finding in my own practice is that there's another layer to pariyatti, to this mastery of the suttas, understanding of the Dhamma, which is that just in diving into the suttas and deepening one's understanding of it and dipping into it day by day, every day, if possible, it starts to have a basic impact on the mind and one's habitual thoughts. It's like touching in with this, it does every day. The mind starts to turn in that direction. It's what comes up when one comes into contact with phenomena. Like the words of the Buddha are fresh and alive in one's mind. And also what I've noticed is that it has a more, even just direct visceral impact. There's a feeling which comes about from reading a sutta, which just is really not comparable to reading worldly novels or magazine articles or even the teachings of contemporary masters or meditation instructors. There's a different flavor to the words of the Buddha. And that flavor seems to work on a very deep level. It turns the mind in a way it's not quite touched by anything else. And the corresponding impact of all this is that when one does develop one's daily practice of sila and samadhi and panya, it has a foundation on which to rest. It has something deeper to guide it. And this can ripen in something deeper coming forth. Maybe in time, coming to some kind of full realization. But even just the momentary, day by day, bits of pativedi, realizing some place where one is getting caught up, or something where one is causing discomfort for oneself or another. It's like when one's mind is always looking through the lens of the Buddha's words, then one starts to notice how that applies to everyday life, to everyday phenomena. That this world that we live in and operate in was the same world that the Buddha lived in. This was the same world which he saw. This was the same world which his disciples lived in. So the words he was presented were grounded in this reality that we experience every moment. And it was being given through the lens of that reality to people who are dwelling in the same world that we live in now. So it's like just turning one's mind to that lens, it gives us the chance to look through the eye of the Buddha. How did he see the world? And with that shift of perspective, just always bringing us a little bit closer. Maybe we'll offer that for reflection tonight.
I can wait your turn. possible. It's very possible.